Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
I don't know if I answered your question properly.
The wines had to match the grandeur in some ways. They have to be high quality. They have to, you know, be up to your standards.
And I think they are. We have Brooks Painter, who's actually oversees both wineries. And then we have our own winemaker, Peter Valeno, who's really good. He's been here about 9 years now. And we have a great cellar master, I think a dedicated crew. And I, when they want something, you know, I try to make sure it's rational, and maybe I negotiate a price, but the best equipment, we try to buy the best vineyards or buy the best grapes. And, you know, the quality is our, you know, and my name's attached to it. If it's not the highest quality I could possibly make, I don't want to be involved with it. So I think, you know, you have to be the judge, but I think we're making really good quality wines. And I'm really pleased with what we're doing.
And such a diverse portfolio. Something really stood out to me. You said that you wanted to make a wine for everybody that comes to your door that they would like and can afford. That was very important to you.
Yeah, and a lot of Napa Valley wineries don't do that. You know, they're going to, maybe they think it's beneath them. I don't know. But I'm a business guy too, you know, and maybe by selling some sweet wine, I can invest the money for my premium reds. So, for instance, we have a wine here. It's called La Fantasia. Look, I know that not everybody comes for the wine. A lot of people come to see the building. Some of them don't even drink wine, or they're a casual wine drinker, or they're a sweet wine drinker. To me, I'd be an idiot not to make something that's light, fizzy, a little bit sweet and fruity. Yeah. I'd be an idiot, and low alcohol. And so we do, La Fantasia and a couple other wines, and we sell so much of that, and it's great. And I took a risk. I had to buy tanks that were double-walled because it might explode, and a bottle filler that was a lot more expensive because it could explode if it weren't made properly. And anyway, it's really worked. It's a wine I copied out of Italy. It's called, I'm afraid to tell you, I won't tell you.
Okay.
I shouldn't talk about it because I don't want other people doing it. But in any case, more Satui, we'd make less wines here. But yeah, I want, again, to have a wine for basically everybody who comes in. What surprised me is that we get, you might say, masses of people, but we also get the aficionado, the people that really appreciate and know good wine and will spend money on. We just had a couple dinners, Cinquecento dinners. To be a Cinquecento Cavaliere, 500 nights, you have to, opening purchase is $5,000. And we have a full club, and we sold, do you remember, it was like $165,000 worth of wine at this dinner, and there were 70 and 80 people at each dinner. So I guess my point is, we're selling wines that are relatively inexpensive, and we're selling some wines that are quite expensive and selling them. Absolutely. We sell total reserves, it's after Cabernet, it's our biggest selling wine. We sell a tremendous amount of reserves, 3,500, 4,000 cases of reserves, so at high prices.
Yeah, there's a lot of complaints going on in the industry right now about high price points and, you know, consumers not as willing to spend, but...
I have an opinion on that.
Great. I was hoping.
I think Napa... I have to be careful. I think some Napa Valley wines are overpriced. And I think ours are more moderately, when I say high prices, I don't think we're as high priced mm-hmm. as a lot of the competition, mm-hmm. but relatively high priced. For instance, our regular Cabernet that we sell a lot of, $50, $55. And yeah. Most people, I think, are getting more. One of the wines I'm going to pour you mm-hmm. now, a reserve, is $98. Mm-hmm. I don't want to offend other wineries and create enemies. I think price of grapes has gotten astronomically high, partly because the county has so many restrictions, what you can plant, stream setbacks, slope setback, all this stuff, and now they want even more. I don't know if you're familiar with the proposed yeah. legislation.
Yeah.
You can't cut trees, on and on and on. You know, we're Mendocino County, no slope ordinance, no stream setback ordinance. You can cut trees, you know, and we try to, you know, I'm an environmentalist. Yeah. We put almost all our land in the land trust, never to be built upon. But so you have to be good stewards of the land. But Napa County is just going crazy. So the price of grapes is real high, and subsequently the price of wine is real high. And I think a lot of wineries, they start out, you know, the first year, and they have a $100 or $150 bottle of wine with no background, maybe no reputation, and maybe not even great quality. And I think that we may be shooting ourselves in the foot. That's what I think.
Are you worried about the future of Napa Valley? You've yeah. not watched for 40 years.
So I do worry about it because, one, I think it's somewhat overrun with housing.
Yeah.
And now that traffic's a big problem and people can't afford to live here, a lot of our employees live in Lake County, Petaluma, right?
Yeah.
Fairfield, American yeah. Canyon. So what we're doing, I bought two places, one an old people's care home, and we're renting at subsidized rents to employees to try to get them off the road and closer. I have one, and both of them are in St. Helena, actually. And then we pay people to carpool or to take a bus or to bicycle or to walk. So people are making pretty good money from that. Some of them are doing it anyway, so it's just gravy for them. But we're trying to figure out ways, and we're going to talk about maybe staggering the workforce too, mm-hmm. so they come in later, earlier, and when there's not heavy traffic. So we're very cognizant of that, and we're trying to do what we can regarding that.
So but you actively problem solving. You're not just worried about it. You're actually taking active
yeah,
steps.
Yeah, we're taking action. Yeah.
To change the situation.
We'll soon have 15 rooms, or no, 16 rooms and apartments for employees.
Wow. Yeah. Well, thank
we're
you
doing
for that.
A remodel now on the old people's home.
It's an acute issue, and I'm really thrilled to hear that you're, actively at least
and that's,
changing your.
Excuse me. I think that's why a lot of local residents are pushing for these stricter ordinances, because what they're really mad about is high price of housing and the traffic.
Yeah.
The truth is, most of the traffic is not generated by the wineries. Most of it is generated by the locals. Moms taking their kids to school when they ought to be walking, and going to Safeway or whatever they're doing. So most of it is, I think the study said that 81% is not winery related or winery tourist related. But anyway, they see the wineries as the problem.
I know that you're very well known for your philanthropy. There's some causes that are very near and dear to your heart. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I mentioned earlier I was always a saver, but you know, I have no future now. I'm getting old, so I'm starting to donate more and more to, like, I donated $1.6 million to the Boys and Girls Club to get that started. And I just donated to Wheel last week for Old Bale Mill because the wheels wearing out. And so, yeah, a lot of different things. And a lot of environmental causes, mm-hmm. a lot of wildlife causes and animal shelters.
Yeah. It's mostly local causes, is that correct?
Yeah, I try to do everything in Napa County. However, I know this Russian guy used to be a boxer, and he's got a school in Ukraine for young kids to keep them out of trouble. So I donate the place here to him. I donate 20 cases of wine. So I do some out of the area too, but we just donated to the Humane Society over in Santa Rosa, but mainly it's Napa County.
Very good. So in terms of future legacy, what do you see for Castello d'Amoroso moving forward?
Well, I don't want it to get much bigger. One, I don't need to make more money. Two, I want to keep the quality up. I don't want it to become a mob scene. And Saturday afternoons, it can get really busy. I want it to be an intimate, enjoyable experience for all the visitors. And so we're basically at our limit. And my self-imposed limit, because probably we could continue to grow, but I don't want to grow. I like it the way it is. Again, the quality, you know, can we make good quality if we continue to grow? And we don't need to grow. So for both wineries, we're going to not grow much in the future.
Thank you for this. I know we have some wine tasting coming. I'm very excited. I think we're going to start with a Chardonnay.
And all right. It's going to be too warm, but
It's in the fridge, so it's coming.
Yeah. I already. I'm sorry.
Brownie too. The Chardonnay and the Brownie.
Yeah, please.
Meanwhile, a burning question for you: what do you drink yourself?
Okay, often. You know, I don't know why I do it. I try to save the best for the customers. So often I drink this Sangiovese. It's called Voyager, which I think is really good. And the Old Vine Zinfandel, which I call Zingaro, and Gypsy.
Gypsy, yeah.
And
there they come.
You know, maybe I'm stupid. And I enjoy them. They're really good wines, easy to drink. Not real tannic, and so I enjoy them with food. And I don't need to age them 10 years or so before they're
Do you drink your own wines exclusively, or do you like wines from Italy and from other countries?
Yeah, I have a small collection of Italian wine, some French wine, occasionally an Austrian wine, not really Spanish wines, but mainly I drink my own, I have to be honest. But I drink wines from elsewhere as well. And in Italy, I have a collection of wine as well. Yeah, this is going to be too cold. You care to try?
So you have a couple properties in Italy, whereabouts?
Outside of Siena, 27 years ago, I bought this monastery. It's over 1,000 years old. And I've renovated it recently. It took over 5 years to renovate, and I tried to keep the style that it was, but now there's no more dirt floors, and it has electricity and toilets and running water and so forth. So, and I love it. It's on 60 acres. We have no grapes, but we have an olive orchard, and we're out in the countryside, and then I'm an investor in a castle hotel about 4 miles away, and then I bought a Medici palace. I'm crazy, it's stupid, and I let it just linger for years with some minor renovations, and now we started making a wine called Vinsanto.
Ah,
have you heard of Vinsanto?
Of course, yes.
Okay, and what happened? One, the town's giving me pressure, to do something with the building.
Yeah.
And it's an out-of-the-way place, a cute little village with a castle at the top, but nobody goes there anymore. So, I was thought of starting a hotel or something, but mm-hmm. I'd lose my shirt. So what happened, this guy that was the most famous Vinsanto maker in Italy, Ettore Falvo, he retired. Went sailing and stuff, but he got bored, and he lives about 15 miles away. He was introduced to me by another friend, so we formed a little business, and now we're on our fourth vintage of Vinsanto.
How exciting.
He's about a year and a half older than I. He wants to have the wine 10 years old before we start selling it. And I said, wait a minute, I'm 77, you're 78 and a half. we won't be alive to sell this stuff. So anyways, right now I'm going with him. But so a good part of the Medici place is full of not the normal size barrels. These are like 60, 70 liter barrels.
Yeah.
And they're made out of cherry and chestnut and oak as well. And we're doing everything traditionally. We pick the grapes when they're ripe, not overripe, ripe. And then we lay them out in straw mats that we tear up 8 high.
Yeah.
And then we let them dry out, and then we start fermenting them in January, late January. And then we bung them up in these little barrels, and we don't touch it. Don't top it, and don't do anything for at least 5 and who knows, maybe 10 years.
Labor-intensive process, without a doubt. It's very intense. There's many steps to that process. What you're describing is a lot of work.
Yeah, it's a lot of work.
It's a very intense process.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, you never shied away from a challenge. Clearly, that hasn't changed.
Well, I have second thoughts whether I should have done it. I kind of got talked into it, but I'm kind of happy I did it. Whether we make any money on it. But, again, you don't have to make money at everything. So I'm okay at that as well. So anyway, it's good collaboration. And now we're using the building. And hopefully we're going to make a good product. But you get a lot of evaporation. And you don't know what you get till you eventually take the bung out of the barrel.
Yeah.
And then you get what you get. And some
angels
barrels
get very drunk, right? Angels share.
Some barrels may not be very good. This wine, our Reserve Chardonnay, we entered it in the San Francisco International tasting.
Yes.
With over 2,000 white wines, and was voted the best white wine of the entire tasting.
Wow,
so congratulations. We just got the results, 5-6 weeks ago, something like that?
I love the silk screen in the bottle, too. It's absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah. So we were really gratified for that honor.
And the nose in this wine is so seductive. We were smelling it while we were chatting, and I noticed the vintage is 2017, is that correct? Yeah, which 17 was a bit of a challenge for a lot of wineries. How was it for you?
It was a challenge, but I think overall the wines are good, and Brooks, he's a good blender, he's a good winemaker, and so is Peter, and we've never had a bad wine. We've never had a wine we had to bulk out. Some vintages are better than others. 2011 wasn't great, but they're still good. And I'm happy with the wines.
Yeah, I have to say it's absolutely delicious. I'm not surprised in the least that it won such high honors. It's got a beautiful texture. Is this an estate vineyard that was utilized for that?
Is it what?
Was it an estate fruit, estate grapes?
Yeah, it's actually, we bought the grapes from Satui.
Okay.
We're in competition.
Oh, no.
In friendly competition, since I own both, but we're in competition.
So you purchased grapes from Satui?
And they have their own vineyard down in Canaris.
Okay. So you use a combination for your portfolio of purchased fruit and estate fruit.
Right.
Is that correct? Are there different fruit sources you choose every year, every vintage, or are they contracts that you've been
working
with?
Okay, what we try to do is when we find something good, like this Voyager Sangiovese,
mm-hmm.
We try to get a long-term contract, pay them well enough that they don't want to go somewhere else or don't want to rip out the vineyard.
Mm-hmm.
We try to keep the best vineyards.
Got it. And you went ahead and purchased vineyards, as you described earlier, here in Napa Valley as well as Anderson.
Yeah, we have a Cabernet vineyard in the eastern foothills of Napa,
mm-hmm.
Above Coombsville, which we really like, and the wine's called Butala.
Okay.
He was the founder, I think, of the Four Lettermen.
Okay.
That's before your time, but I've never met the guy, but apparently he's a nice guy, and we bought his vineyard. I've been trying to buy another great Cabernet vineyard or raw land, but every time either the price is so high or somehow it falls apart.
Mm.
So we haven't been able to yet.
Well, you certainly have gone to one of my favorite places in the world, Anderson Valley. It's some of the most compelling wines that I've had, particularly with respect to aromatic whites and Pinot Noir.
Yeah, I think I'm a romantic, and sometimes good part of the reason I do something is for the beauty of it. And I love Anderson Valley. It's probably the way Napa County was 70, 80 years ago. Mm-hmm. And the wines are really good. So, yeah, so now we have three vineyards there. Mm-hmm. Or we'll have. And we're planning the wow. third one.
So, Pinot Noir, Chardonnay?
On the third vineyard, the one we're planting, we're going to plant all Italian white varietals, Pinot Grigio, Pinot Bianco, Muscato, Vermentino, anything else? And then we'll plant some Pinot Noir, okay. although we don't really need it.
Right.
Probably we'll sell some, we'll sell the inferior quality, keep the best quality. And then the other two vineyards, oh no, and we're going to plant Gewurztraminer. We make a Gewurztraminer
oh, yes.
here.
Wow.
And we already have, at the first vineyard next to the brewery there, we have Gewurztraminer and we have Pinot Noir and Pinot Grigio. And then we own it half with Satui, so they own the other half. And they have Riesling and Pinot Noir. And then the second vineyard, Morning Dew. I don't know if you ever heard of that.
Actually, I have.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I've been there quite a bit,
vineyard.
So, yeah.
And we bought that 2.5 years ago, and it's all Pinot Noir.
Wow. Well, it certainly is going to make a handsome addition to your portfolio that you source fruit from, you know, for your bottling.
Yeah, and then we have a Pinot Noir vineyard over by Sebastopol. We're going to call it Cresta d'Oro, Gold Ridge,
Golden
like Gold Ridge soil.
Yes.
And we're also planting a couple acres of Chardonnay there.
Wow. Well, I can't stop smelling this because the fragrance is really quite beautiful. And this is a wine that has aging potential, in my view. I think this will lay down nicely. It's clearly beautiful to drink now. Is this part of your philosophy? You want wines to be enjoyable but also to age?
Yeah, and we, our reserves, we're trying to start selling them when they're 5 years old. And our Cabernet, we're trying to sell it when it's 4 years old, not 2 years old,
yeah.
like a lot of wineries, and encouraging people to age them further if they want to reach their full potential. So we're not making wine, well, it's not, I mean, the Sangiovese and the Zingaro are wines that can be drunk young, and Merlot as well, but we're making some wines with aging potential as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're very involved. I know I've been to events here, and you're often personally present, greeting the guests. And this really is very intimate, very personalized experience when you become a member of your club and come to the parties. Is that correct?
Yeah. And we get to know a lot of our so-called customers, and sometimes we become friends with them as well. So sometimes I even have them over for dinner. Yeah.
It's really important to you, isn't it? Because clearly, you know, you don't have to be physically present as much, but you choose to.
Well, in the last almost 3 months, I haven't been physically present much because I had a knee operation, a
right.
knee replacement,
right.
and I couldn't walk, and now I'm yeah. still hobbling. But yeah, I've always been hands-on because it's one thing somebody telling you what's going on, but sometimes it's a whole different reality when you observe what's going on.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's not the same reality as what you heard from the person telling you. So I like to be involved.
You know, again, there's so many marketing woes, it feels like, when it comes to the wine business, and, you know, way more questions than answers. From the vantage point of your breadth and depth of experience and being so tremendously successful in a very sustainable way, what advice or what observations can you offer?
If you want to go into the wine business, figure out first how you're going to sell it. Because it's hard making wine, but it's a lot harder selling wine. And so if you can't figure out how you're going to sell it and what your competitive advantage is and what you're going to do different differently that somebody else is not doing, then maybe the wine business is not the right place for you unless you're a lifestyle winery that
yeah.
you know, it's a hobby and you don't mind losing some money. And then I'd say pay attention to details. You know, this little thing doesn't seem important, that little thing, but they're all important. And if you take care of all the little things, in summation, I think the whole will, maybe it won't be perfect, but it'll strive towards perfection. I think details are so important. How people dress, how you know, their demeanor with the customer, how the place looks. Are there flowers in the bathrooms? Is the medieval music on? It's all this stuff, and I think it's real important. You're creating, to me, the quality of the wines is paramount. Okay, I understand that. But you're also creating an atmosphere, hopefully, in which you energize people that that want to buy your wine. And when you interface with a customer, there's a lot of good wines in Napa County and elsewhere. If you can form a relationship with that customer, they're buying you as much as they're buying the wine. I'm convinced of that, and maybe you think differently. But we have some salespeople that they're so good at interfacing with the visitor, they sell so much wine. But they're just really good at creating relationship, and where people come back and they're asking for this salesperson, or they want to go over to his house for dinner or whatever. And so I think it's a quality, the best quality you can possibly have, and then create a relationship with the visitor so that when he goes away, he doesn't know he's buying you, but he's buying you as much as he's buying the wine. Do you agree with that at all?
You know, let me go on record by saying that this is music to my ears. The words that you speak are 100% accurate. And I believe they were true when you started the business. And I believe they're even more true today. Perhaps the forms of communication has changed and people get caught in digital media and such like that. But it's that irreplaceable conduit that you create, that connection between yourself and your guest that truly speaks to the product and truly sells the product. Is that not true?
Yeah, I agree. I believe it's true. And to me, you go out of your way to be friendly, to be polite, to do a little extra. And the visitor will remember that. And hopefully he'll want to come back, where the winery before, they were a little rude or condescending or not very friendly. And he won't want to go back there. And we're not perfect. We get complaints, but we... customer service, customer service, customer service. We really try to stress that, and hopefully we're somewhat successful at that.
Oh, you're not just somewhat successful. We were talking earlier how I've been very fortunate to attend a number of your events, and I would describe this as deliriously happy faces that were surrounding me the table.
I met so many interesting people and connected with so many interesting people. And I'm not behind the bar now. You know, I had a bad knee and I'm starting to lose my hearing a little bit. And don't get old, by the way.
I'm trying.
But before, I was behind the bar a lot. And, you know, and you're really being really involved, hands-on. You really get a good feel for what works and what doesn't work, and who's giving you a line, and as far as reporting to you, and who's got it pretty much down.
What is it that relaxes you? What is it that, you know, makes you just very happy?
I think making other people happy makes me happy.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.